Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, it's bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tis the season for bird counts. We got the Christmas bird counts underway this month and the Cape Cod waterfowl census that happened this past weekend.
Yes, yes. December's a busy month for counting bird people like myself. Gets a little difficult because, you know, there's other things you're supposed to be doing in December. Thinking about other people instead of birds, things like that.
There's room for both.
Difficult things. Yes, right. So the waterfowl census happened. It had an old school flavor in that it was cold and ponds were frozen over, which doesn't happen so much anymore. I was expecting there to be, you know, it just shows you that I don't know anything. This whole thing is a fraud, Mindy. I don't know anything about birds. That's what I learn anew every day. I don't know anything about birds. So I fully predicted that it would be great and we'd get this influx of ducks from further north because there was a deep freeze further north. I mean, really cold, like up in southern Canada and places like that. And I figured that would freeze over the big lakes and things that, you know, ducks stay further north now because they can, because things don't freeze up further north. So I'm like, oh, great. They're all going to come down here now. And, you know, it was a pretty boring run-of-the-mill waterfowl count. I didn't see more than usual. I don't know if other people did, but I cover East Ham, which has some really nice kettle ponds with some pretty high diversity of ducks on them. But, you know, I just saw the usual stuff. Lower numbers of certain things. And so I don't know anything. I thought we'd get all kinds of ducks because of the deep freeze.
I mean, they're unpredictable, right? You just don't know.
Yeah, they are unpredictable. You know, I rolled up to my first pond, which is this little private property pond in a little cottage colony. And, you know, it often will have 180 hooded mergansers.
Wow.
Hooded mergansers, if you don't know what that is, look it up.
They're beautiful.
Stunning animal. I mean, never mind bird. It's just a beautiful creature. That if you ever got close to one, they're often not close. You just see this little duck. But if you were close to one, you'd be like, holy cow, these are around here? And they are. They're pretty common on small ponds here in the winter. But that pond, instead of having 180 hooded mergansers, had ice and four very confused-looking American black ducks standing on the ice. Like, I could have sworn there was water here yesterday. the bigger ponds were okay. Excuse me, but a lot of the smaller ponds were frozen over. But it's just this census, it's important. It goes back, any kind of long-term data like this can be important. And this goes back, 40 years. I'd have to look. I'm making up a number. I should know. It was started by the Cape Cod Bird Club, and Blair Nicola ran it for a long time, and it's back under the Cape Cod Bird Club now. And it's the first weekend in December every year. And it just gives you a nice perspective across the decades. And you see things like we don't see canvasbacks anymore so much. That's a beautiful duck of shallow ponds that eats a lot of dives and eats vegetation. And for whatever reason, you can really just see them on Nantucket in any numbers anymore. But they used to be more common back in the beginning of this count, and they're pretty well gone. They've shifted their wintering range further west for mysterious reasons, you know, and so you can see that in this data. I mean, mainly it's just an excuse to get out and go birding. It's like it's like a warm-up act for the Christmas bird counts, right?
You're
getting out in these areas and kind of scouting out any interesting other birds. Of course, I'm not just counting ducks. I'm looking at everything that's out there.
Right. And how many Christmas bird counts are you doing?
Well, let's see how many I can get away with. I typically do five.
Wow.
Right. You know, like back in my bachelor days, I was just sort of always available for everything. And I got in the habit of doing five. There's one I have to do because I'm the compiler. That's the Truro count on the 30th. And that's always difficult to schedule because it's fairly new and there's all these older counts I have to work around and figure out when they are. But I also do the Taunton Middleborough count. It's one of my favorites. So I cover Lakeville, like the big reservoirs there and a lot of really nice woods. And that's because I grew up in Brockton. And that's, you know, I'm sort of maintaining that connection to my homeland there in Plymouth County. You know, and I'll do, I usually help someone on the Cape Cod count. Ironically, I don't have my own area on the Cape Cod count, even though that's where I live. That's the one count circle I live in. And nobody seems to need me, but it's just such an old count. And there are all these old established areas where people have had them for many years. And then the mid Cape count I've done for many, many years. Even when I lived in Florida, it somehow would coincide with when I was home. And so I have a pretty long streak of doing that just about every year.
Yeah.
That's probably the best one, just because of the variety of habitats, the amount of land area, the amount of ponds and marshes and, you know, Nantucket Sound and Cape Cod Bay and big Sandy Neck. There's so much good habitat on the mid Cape count that it tends to just crush all of the other counts in terms of the number of species.
It's plus a lot of good, not a competition, a Mark. Come on.
Everything's a competition. Come on.
So listen, for folks who don't know what the Christmas bird count is, why don't you explain what it is?
Yeah. And so it is one of the oldest citizen science projects. It started in, it's like 120, you know, it's right around, it's like 125 years old or something like that. And it was started by Frank Chapman, an early ornithologist, as an alternative to this old tradition of going out hunting on Christmas Day. And in a competitive way, because everything's a competition, it was competitive hunting where, you know, the men would go out in the morning and see how many birds they could bag or whatever, and then come back when dinner was ready. And Frank Chapman was like, well, why don't we see how many we can count instead of shoot? And it just took off from there. And it's now, you know, all over the continent and down into Central and maybe South America now. I'd have to check. But so everyone is the same. You pick a day and it's a 15-mile diameter circle. And then you subdivide that into subsectors and you hand those off to competent birders. And, you know, they kind of find their own team. So there are all these sub teams, and then everybody comes together traditionally at the end of the day to compare numbers and put it all together in a way that makes sense. You know, some people are, COVID has killed some of the compilations, which is too bad, because I think that's one of the best parts of it, that social aspect of it at the end of the day. Go back to someone's house, there's chili, there's a big pile of boots, people telling stories, people keeping that rare bird in their back pocket with just a little a corner of their mouth is just rising up a little bit because they know they've got this rare bird that no one else saw and they're going to wait till the very end to tell it. You know, the compilations are great. And it was a great way for young birders, me as a young birder, to learn, just listening to the old guard talk about what they saw versus what they expected. And that's kind of how you learn bird distributions. You know, like, oh, I can't believe we didn't have any of these, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of people are still doing the compilations, but some of them have gone away, which is too bad, which is one of the many things COVID wrecked. But yeah, I try to do one, and, you know, there'll be compilations for some of the other counts. But that's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah, it's good information, right? I mean, to look back on what's changed over the years, the trends, yeah. All right. Joe in West Harwich has sent us a note. He says, looking back at my collection of snowy owl photos, I noticed that some were from November and many from December. I'm wondering if there have been any sightings on the Cape or at Logan Airport, and if we have any early indicators as to whether this could be an eruption year.
Right. A lot of people were wondering that. You know, I think at some point we'll talk about winter finches, and there was forecasted to be a big year for these northern songbirds to come south. But that's not really connected to snowy owls, as far as we know. Whatever cycle drives the lemming populations in the, you know, eastern Canadian Arctic that determines whether or not we get snowy owls. If say Arctic Quebec sees a huge lemming boom, which happens about every 4 years, then we should get snowy owls, right? Because there's just a lot of them. And, you know, they're not starving. You know, there's this old idea that when we see snowy owls because they're poor starving snowy owls. Well, no, I mean, if they were starving, they probably wouldn't have made it this far.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty good at hunting. And the idea that they're starving is not borne out by Norm Smith of Mass Audubon, his decades of data on having snowy owls in the hand and measuring them at Logan Airport. But I haven't looked in a while. Somebody had one, and this was absolutely bizarre. Somebody near Barnstable Harbor sent in pictures of a snowy owl sitting on the corner of the railing of their roof deck, looking down at them.
Hmm.
I don't know, a month ago, something like that. And I was like, oh. And then I looked in eBird, and there were almost no other sightings south of Canada. And I was like, wow, this person is extremely lucky. maybe this is the first salvo of a big snowy owl year. And I haven't heard of any since, but I might have missed some. I would guess there's probably, you know, a couple at Logan Airport, a couple at Plum Island up on the North Shore always gets them, you know, even in a fairly low year. But here on the Cape, I haven't been hearing.
Yeah, it. Yeah. Usually you do hear about those because everybody gets all excited when we start seeing snowy owls. So, yeah.
Yeah, those people were so lucky. I mean, they watched it cough up a pellet onto their lawn. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're such beautiful birds. I think all of the owls are beautiful, but yeah. Very
thriving. Yeah. It's like Nantucket. Nantucket had one within the last few days.
Oh.
Within the last week. Out. Yeah. All right.
Okay.
So
good to know.
Nantucket's had one and Plymouth Beach. Hmm. So there's a non-zero amount of snowy owls out there. So keep an eye out.
Okay. You mentioned the winter finch. So tell us about the winter finch update. We're expecting it to be a good showing. Has it been?
Right. So we're still kind of waiting. There were these early indications, and the prediction was that it was going to be a big winter finch flight year here in the east. The biologists, the network of biologists, all sent in their data on, you know, black and white spruce cone crops and birch seed crops and mountain ash berry production and all this stuff that determines whether this suite of species will run out of food and move south. And it seemed like it was going to be a big year. And there were some early indications. We had red-breasted nuthatches seem to be moving in numbers, and that's often an indication. You know, they rely on conifer seeds. So they were moving out of the boreal forest, and it seemed to be a good purple finch year. Purple finches were moving mm-hmm. south, but they do kind of every year. And then we started seeing some evening grosbeaks. I mean, I didn't, but I saw the reports, and a few people got them at their feeders. And then a couple people had Bohemian waxwing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the more northerly cousin, more colorful, a little bit bigger cousin of cedar waxwings that they're much more northerly. I mean, they'll be in Alaska in the winter. And mountain ash berries is one of the things they eat. But we always get a couple. And, you know, there was one in Wellfleet and another one in Provincetown, I think, or North Truro. But then nothing has really materialized. No red poles yet, no crossbills. But there's still time. Sometimes these things don't arrive until like late December.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's more of a midwinter flight. And so there's still time. And so, you know, keep your feeders stocked and keep your eyes peeled and your ears peeled or your Merlin going if you don't have good ears and you know, see what you can find. And I still haven't gotten an evening. I've got a platform feeder specifically for evening grosbeaks because they're big fat things and they don't do well on the standard tube feeder. They want room to spread out. And so they like bigger hopper feeder and platform feeders. And I got one just for them and I've never had one on it.
Not yet.
Right now I have a squirrel on it. I had a pellet gun.
Squirrel's got to eat too, right?
Yeah, he knows I'm live on the air and I can't do anything about it.
It's almost like when I put my hand on the slider to the backyard, any squirrels in the backyard they're off and running because they know the dog is coming out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News This Morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, we have a hummingbird sighting on the vineyard, and I know that Harry's been talking to you. Harry from Chilmark. Mark's been talking to you and sending you some photos. He sent us a note this morning that says, "Hi, guys, just wanted to clarify that we had brought our feeders in back in October. Around November 23rd, Karen looked out the window and saw a hummer feeding on a still-blooming Mexican sage that she planted in the spring. She called me. I contacted Mark, who told me to get the heated feeder, which we did just before the cold snap. He is still here and doing well." Tell us about this hummingbird, Mark.
Right. And so, yeah, thanks to Harry for getting in touch. I didn't realize it at the time, but somehow, though we have, I don't know, sometimes two or three every winter here on the Cape, that Martha's Vineyard had never had a Rufus hummingbird or an Allen's hummingbird, one of these rare winter hummingbirds. Nantucket has had them. Nantucket has had calliope, even more rare things. And so I was shocked that this was the first one. And we're still trying to nail down the species. It's not an adult. It might be a young, it looks like a young male. So it's got a lot of Rufus on it, but not all covering it like a beautiful adult male would be. And it's got some gorget feathers growing in the middle of the throat. But, you know, the identification, I don't think we're going to get it banded. People who are licensed to ban hummingbirds, there's only two in the state. And one is in Brewster and one is in Western Mass. And I don't think we're going to get anybody out there to band it. So it's going to come down to a photo finish on this bird to establish that first, you know, either way, it'll be the first hummingbird in that genus, Silasphorus, to be recorded on Martha's Vineyard. So it's a big deal. I didn't realize that at the time until I, you know, alerted some of the local biologists there on the island. And in the last week, people have started visiting. Harry was nice enough to have, you know, a contingent of experts come initially and then figure out how to get other people on it. And so some of the birders have already seen it and they're starting to post about it. And so I'm sure they're all anxious to get it identified, but typically you want a bander to have it in the hand and take measurements and photos of like the width of the tail feathers and things like that. That's how challenging it is, but you can get an idea of that from photos, and ultimately it'll come down to the Mass Avian Records Committee and whether they're convinced they can tell this from an Allen's hummingbird by the photos,
yeah. And luckily Harry got some photos, right? So, I mean, you could at least get some sort of indication. What about this heated hummingbird feeder? Is that something you're recommending?
Well, so the thing with the, you know, if you have a hummingbird in late November, it's not leaving. So, I mean, it's either going to stay and survive if it has some kind of food, or it's going to die, you know, trying to move somewhere. Mm-hmm. But it's done with migration is what I'm trying to say.
So it's going to hang out. Yeah.
It didn't go to Western Mexico. It went to Martha's Vineyard.
And guess
and that's
what?
It. Harry, that's where it is for the winter. And
Harry's called in. Harry's on the line.
Okay.
I see Harry from Chilmark. Hey, Harry.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good.
I got a last minute email just now from Luann Johnson, who's the naturalist that I've been contacting about this guy. She was one of the first birders to come and see him. She reached out to a guy named Peter Pyle, who wrote Identification Guide to North American Birds. He is a West Coast guy who sees a lot of these things. And she shared Lanny McDowell's images, and he has identified this hummingbird with confidence as an adult female Rufus hummingbird.
Hmm. Oh, perfect. Yeah, Peter Pyle is the guy. When Luann said she was contacting Peter, I was like, well, we'll get an answer one way or the other. And the Mass Avian Records Committee will take that very seriously, because he wrote If you've ever done bird banding or been to a bird banding station, you might have noticed a book the size of an unabridged dictionary that the banders are constantly grabbing and referring to. And it's the technical manual for bird banding, identifying every bird and every age of every bird by looking at the molt and the width of feathers and new versus old feathers. It's very technical. And so, yeah, he's the guy, and he is based out of California, where they have to tell Rufus from Allen's routinely. So thank you. That's
great update. Yeah. Harry, how exciting, huh?
Last minute. I know, it's amazing. If anybody wants to come see the bird, we have our yard gate open from 7 to 9 in the morning, which is his busy time. If anybody wants a good picture, you can come around noon when the light's better. He's just less frequent at the feeder. But he's here regularly all day long, and he seems to be doing well. We're just hoping that he survives.
I think you mean she.
All right. Yes, now it's she.
That's right. I know we imprinted on this idea that it was a young male, and you know, it's really hard to tell young males from females unless you're Peter Pyle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for Pierre's email this morning, because that was at the last minute. But apparently an adult female Rufus.
All right, Harry, thanks. Well, thanks for sharing your story and letting people see
it. Thanks for sharing the bird with people. Yeah. They really appreciate
you're
that.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for calling in too. Thanks, Harry. Appreciate that. That is exciting. I mean, you know, and it's great that everybody can go check it out. All right, let's talk to Kathy calling from Centerville. Hi, Kathy.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. I was at my sister's house the other day in Centerville. It was just barely daybreak, and I heard a Rufus-sided Tui, where they're just with their distinctive drink your tea call. And I hadn't heard one in years. I used to hear them in Brewster when I lived near Nickerson State Park, but I have not, since I've moved to the Mid-Cape, heard one. And I just wondered, like, where are they all? What's happened to them?
Wait, just to be clear, you heard one the other day?
Yeah, in early daybreak, a Rufus-sided Tui. I used to hear them constantly in Brewster, and so I'm very familiar with their call. And I couldn't see him. It was still fairly light, but I definitely heard him, and I hadn't heard one in a long time.
Yeah, no, it's just, this is a weird time to hear one singing. They used to be the Rufus-sided Tohi in the 80s when I was growing up, but for many years they gave it the much lamer name, Eastern Tohi. How boring is that? But they still have those Rufus sides. And so, Eastern Tohi, and they have that song. They're very common on the Cape in any kind of woods with an understory of oak. The Cape is one place where they're still very common as a breeding bird. I get them under my feeders when they in migration in spring. Here in Harwich, where it's very oaky. So they're still doing
okay. I'm glad to hear that, because I lived in Marston's Mills for the last 10 years, and I had a really yard full of birds, and I never heard one. And then at my sister's house in Centerville, I heard one, and I just was glad to hear it.
If you just went for a walk in a conservation area with some oak woods, and, you know, with a decent understory in the spring, they start coming back in April, and then by May, you should be hearing them singing quite a bit in woodlands here on the Cape. Especially anything with scrub oak, they like scrub oak and young, regenerating oaks in the understory, but still pretty common here. And a few do overwinter. It's just they're hard to find in the winter, unless you're a birder and you're going around playing your screech owl tape in the thickets, and maybe you get a couple. But hearing one sing in the winter. Yeah, I mean, finding one at all is unusual in the winter, and then hearing one sing is very, very unusual. They typically just give these.
Yeah, he was singing for about 5 minutes straight. I was amazed. Wow.
That's amazing. Yeah. They give they have a call, distinctive chuink, chuink. Yeah. They give that in the winter quite a bit, and they have this little wolf whistle thing they do that all the towhees do. It's a fun. If you ever hear this in a thicket.
That's them?
Yeah.
That's a towhee call. I don't know if that even came through the microphone, but
I heard you.
Yeah. Okay, so Kathy, I think he heard you come and went. Wait, Kathy thinks I'm not around anymore. I got to sing a little song for her.
I appreciate it. It was really lovely to hear him again.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
All right, well, thank you. Yeah. All right.
866-999-4626 is our number for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So the Brookline Bird Club did a winter pelagic trip out of Hyannis. What did they see? It was pretty good, right?
Yeah. And so the Brookline Bird Club is this venerable old bird club, and they are famous for running these pelagic trips out of Hyannis aboard the Helen H. And typically they go straight south, they go past Nantucket, they cross the Nantucket Shoals, and they keep going out to the canyons 100 miles south of Nantucket. So that's the edge of the continental shelf where these canyons are sort of carved in, and you know, the break in the depths and temperature, there's just interesting birds out there, really, really cool things you can't see many other places. But this time in winter, it's a little different strategy. And so the best place to be in winter might be like George's Bank, where the kind of straight east out where, you know, fishing boats go. And they made it, they went across the Nantucket Shoals and they went out as far as the Great South Channel. And they saw, you know, and you have different targets in winter. And so one of the targets was puffins, and they were not disappointed because they saw, you know, they were seeing them like 8 or 10 at a time, just sitting on the water. And puffins, if you're expecting the puffin that's on the cereal box in winter, you might be disappointed. They're more somber looking in winter. The bill looks smaller and the face is sort of gray, but still very cool to see all those puffins out there. They saw a great skua, which was very exciting. A skua is this big beast of a bully bird. It's like a big husky gull that lifts weights and just like kicks sand in the faces of all the other birds. And so they would harass, you know, they're talk about Jaegers a lot, and Jaegers are bullies that harass the terns and steal their fish. Well, the skuas are even bigger and bullier, and they harass gulls and even gannets, as big as gannets are, to steal their food. But they're very, very uncommon, and apparently great skuas are declining in addition. But based on the photos, they concluded that's what this was. So everybody's very excited about that. It's one of the things they hope for. You know, that's a tough boat trip, right? That's not a cruise to the Bahamas, because it was right. cold.
Yeah.
Cold over the weekend, and you know how much colder everything is on a boat. You get cold on a boat in midsummer, never mind.
Right, true. Like
that. Yeah, yeah. And so these people paid their money, and they paid in discomfort to have the opportunity to see these birds. But, you know, there's just stuff out there that is hard or impossible to see from land, like the skua. They saw a lot of northern fulmar, which is kind of an obscure seabird, unless, you know, if you're out fishing on George's Bank, you'd see them in the winter. But you don't really see them from land. They nest in cliff colonies in kind of the far north, and they stay pretty far away from land. They just stay out over the ocean, over cold water. And so they saw quite a few northern fulmar. They're funny looking birds. They're like, their tube noses like shearwater. So they have that specialized bill with the tube on it, a really good sense of smell, but they're sort of stocky. They're like a cross between a gull and a shearwater, and very stocky looking, very cool bird.
Yeah.
And then dovekies, you know, just these winter, these relatives of puffins like dovekies and razorbills, those you can sometimes see from land. And we were going to talk about that too, but, you know, it was overall, this was just a really successful trip, which is what you want when you're braving the cold. You know, right. A lot of things could have gone wrong. The weather could have been even worse. It could have gotten canceled. But everybody was really, really pleased with what they had out there. And they had tons of, like, I'm looking at the list right now. And so the total list was like 22,000 common eiders.
Wow.
4,000 surf scoters, you know, 1,600 white wing scoters, 6,000 black scoters. It almost 2,500 long-tailed ducks. That's about as many. That's about as high a number of long-tailed ducks, which are rapidly declining, as you would see anywhere anymore.
Yeah. They're a beautiful bird too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So good stuff out there for those hardy souls.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more that everybody loves the little dovekies. They're so cute. But sometimes when we get the storms, they blow onto land and you got to either, you know, bring them back to the water, right? They can't get back to the water by themselves.
Yes. Yes, that happens in the winter. If dovekies are out there, you know, if they've, I've got some turkeys out here walking around my yard. If dovekies are out there, and so first of all, the dovekie is the smallest member of that puffin family, the alcids, and they're very, very numerous. We wouldn't know it at our latitude most of the time, but they're in these gigantic nesting colonies in Arctic cliffs. And they will stay for the most part at the edge of the pack ice, and they don't need to go much further south than that. They're just tough as nails. They're the size of a small Nerf football, not the full size Nerf football, the small
ones.
Right. And the same shape too. And they're just adorable pocket size bathtub toy birds, but belying an incredible toughness. So you can see them if one of these people who just stands up at Race Point in Provincetown stares out into the ocean. There have been several small flights of dovekies already starting in November. And one lucky birder found a bunch kind of paddling around in Wellfleet Harbor one day. So if you're lucky, you can find them taking shelter in a harbor. But to get back to what you were asking about, if you get a real bad storm, they will get blown over land and they'll end up in yards and driveways and roads and things, and they can't really take off again. And so, yeah, you would get them to around here locally, you'd get them to Wild Care in Orleans or Cape Wildlife Center, and they'll get them sorted out and released somewhere safe if they can be released.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's happened a lot where somebody took pictures of these weird tracks in the snow in their yard, and it was the tracks of a dovekie kind of like scooching itself along, partly with its feet and partly with its wings, just on its belly, just like flop, flop, flop through someone's
trying
yard
to get back to the water.
Like, boy, yeah. If I ever saw those tracks in the snow, I wouldn't have a clue. It would drive me nuts.
Yeah.
It's not something to see every day. So yeah, you know, the next big storm we get, it's always something to be aware of is the old dovekie in the driveway.
Exactly. All right. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Lynn in Marston's Mills sent us a note. She says, I have a pair of these at my house, and I think they're bluebirds. Aren't we late in the season for these guys? Should I be doing something to protect them? The picture was taken on December 2nd. And she's right. They are bluebirds, right?
I trust your.
It's a bluebird.
As I open this, yeah, it's a bluebird.
Yeah.
Yes, boy, this is one of the another softball lobbed up for me here. it's such a common question, right? For some reason, people just are always surprised to see bluebirds, whatever the time of year. But they're fairly common year-round residents. It's just they sort of hang in the periphery. They don't really make themselves obvious to the casual observer. Like, I know what they sound like, and I'm always aware when they're around, and I've been getting them in my yard. So this morning, for example, I'm walking back from the bus stop, just got rid of the kids for the day. It's a little before 7 a.m. And I look up, and there's this silent flock of at least 12 or 15 bluebirds that were just circling over my yard, circling, and mixed with goldfinches. Typically mixed with goldfinches. There's usually a couple of pine warblers in the periphery working with them, house finches. They all kind of hang together. And ultimately they landed in my neighbor's tree next to my driveway and just hung out there. And then they came down and they spent some time in my other neighbor's cedar eating the cedar fruits. And that's a lot of what they're doing this time of year. If the ground is too cold, if they're not getting insects anymore, then they're looking for fruit. So they'll come to your winterberry, they'll come to holly, other hollies like American holly or inkberry holly. And they love cedar fruits like so many birds. But they're around. I mean, they flock up like robins. They're a lot like robins. They're closely related. They're, you know, related to thrushes. They are around all year. And in the winter, they form flocks and focus on fruit to a large extent.
Yeah.
So very similar to robins, just, you know, definitely not as many of them. I mean, we have tens of thousands of robins in the winter, but it's very common to see little groups of 5, 6, or 10 bluebirds working suburban neighborhoods all winter long.
Yeah, I'd love to see a flock of bluebirds on my holly. I've seen robins, which is great when all the robins come in and they just have a little feast and then they take off.
Yes.
Yeah, fun.
Right. I'm waiting for them to come in and skeletonize my one winterberry. I tried to add some winterberries that I came into, and one turned out to be a male, the one that I planted very prominently. And so that one's sort of useless. And then the other one didn't produce like 2 fruits.
Oh.
So I need to up my winterberry. It's such a beautiful plant to have in the winter with all until the robins come ruin it.
Oh.
But just that because it's a deciduous holly, it loses its leaves and it really just features those bright
red berries. Yeah. Hard to miss those. Landscape. Yeah.
So good for wildlife and such a good landscape plant in the winter.
Yeah. All right. Eric is giving us a call. Not sure from where, but hi, Eric.
Good morning, Mindy and Mark. I'm calling from Sandwich.
Okay.
I have noticed quite a bit of owl activity over the past month or more, much more than that I can ever remember. And it's to the point where I hear them even inside the house, you know, with closed windows and doors. They're very vocal. I think they're barred owls. But I'm trying to understand why they're so prevalent this year over years past.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm going to need you to imitate the call for everybody.
So
come on.
It goes, it's 4 hoots. It's hoo, 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 typically like that.
So that's a great horned owl. It's usually 5. It's hoo, 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 hoo. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Maybe I'm missing one.
6 hoots.
Yeah.
I know it's hard to count past 5 for me. but yeah, the classic hooting, the deep hooting.
Yeah.
That's the standard great horned owl. Barred owl, it could have been a barred owl. They're definitely established in parts of Sandwich, all through really the upper Cape into the mid Cape. And barred owls 30 years ago, there were none. It's a pretty recent thing. And I'll do it. I'll take one for the team. The barred owls are, it's who cooks for you, who cooks for you. Very distinctive, very different.
Yeah,
than a great
that's not it.
But frequently confused. But still, great horned owl. You know, they're very common, and their calls carry over such a long distance. Probably makes them seem more common than they really are. But on a clear winter night, that call really carries. And yeah, they're gearing up. They're such early nesters, as we often talk about. They're thinking about nesting now. They'll be getting serious about it in January, kind of like bald eagles. They bolt, they're big birds with long nesting cycles, and they start it in the middle of winter. And so, yeah, they're thinking about territoriality, and their hormones are working, and they're thinking about nesting already. I had somebody reach out asking about, they were hearing great horned owls somewhere, and they're like, we want to build a box for them. And well, they don't
they're pretty big. Yeah.
There are, I mean, barred owls do, and they're not anywhere near as big as a great horn, but they're pretty big and they nest in boxes. But yeah, great horns they'll nest in an old Cooper's Hawk or crow nest, or, you know, they don't make much of their own. Their favorite thing to do is to nest in a great blue heron nest. In a great blue heron rookery, which we don't really have. I think we have maybe 1 great blue heron rookery on the Cape. But if you go like drive Route 2 west of Boston and you see the great blue heron rookeries, if you go in February and look at all the nests, one of them should have a great horned owl on it. They're lazy. They're big and tough, and they know nobody's going to try to take that nest back from them when they return in the spring. So, yeah.
Yeah. And Eric, thanks for the call.
Wonderful.
Yeah. They're fun to hear. Yeah. Thank you. I usually can hear. I haven't heard the great horned owls in my neighborhood yet, but pretty much every year we do hear them. I think we have screech owls right now.
Yes. they're both very common. And recently I had the experience of, like, I was in bed, and I guess my wife was still up watching the TV out in the living room, and it was kind of loud, and I'm hearing this owl, and I'm like, is that from the TV? It sounds weird. And the reason it sounded weird is because it wasn't half a mile away, like the typical great horned owl you hear. They just carry, and you just, you know, you hear them five neighborhoods over. But this one was right out back, like right over my deck, just sitting at the top of a tree on a windless night. And just, you get that, the full experience of that deep hooting, that close range was really cool. And it just, you know, through the closed windows and over the TV and everything was very loud.
And since we're talking about owls, we mentioned the Christmas bird counts earlier. You got to get up really early to count the owls, right?
Yeah. Or stay up late.
Or stay up late.
Right. And typically you get up early, right? Like, by the end of the day, people are pretty well toast and going to the compilation. They're not going to, like, keep going until midnight counting owls. So you do your owling in the early morning before sunrise. You know, a good owler would start at like 4 a.m. The turkeys are hanging out in my trees, which they don't normally do. I'm sitting on my deck, which this is a new habit of might need to discourage. But yeah, and it's one aspect of the counts that I love doing. My brother and I will, you know, set the alarm for three, you know, and some people will go out even earlier than that. Cause it's just a chance to really focus on owls and try your luck. It's like fishing, you know, you don't know, you don't always get the owls you're looking for, but sometimes you do. And it's just so cool to find owls, and sometimes they'll fly in and you get looks at them. And, you know, like over the years, I didn't used to have any luck with barred owls. And now I get them in when I cover Lakeville and Middleboro on that Taunton Middleboro count. And I've gotten pretty good, and I know where they are, and I'm able to call them in, get them pretty consistently now after years and years of hoping for them and not getting them. And, you know, that's happening on the Cape more and more. And I'm expecting them to eventually be more consistently gettable on the outer Cape. Yeah. They're showing signs of wanting to colonize, like, parts of the Cape Cod National Seashore, but still not seemingly fully established out there.
Not yet.
Yeah. And saw-whet owls, everyone's favorite saw-whet owl.
Oh, yeah, they're so darn cute. Yeah.
And getting those, and we do get them in the winter here on the Cape. And it's just fun to hear their little toots and wail. They make these kind of creepy wailing sounds and whatever. And there are some pockets where you can really get good numbers of them. On the outer Cape in particular. So they're a lot of fun.
All right. Since we're talking about owls, Amy sent you a photo of a long-eared owl that she found, unfortunately, deceased. We don't have a lot of those, do we?
No. That's an owl you'd be really excited about if you got one on a Christmas bird count. And I know there are some secret locations for them. I know they have actually bred recently, one or two places on Nantucket. But as a breeding bird, they're exceptionally rare in Massachusetts, and they're on the state endangered species list as a breeding bird. And then in winter, you know, there was a migration period in October and November where there were a couple of sightings of them here on the Cape. Very lucky people came across long-eared owls. And they're very, very inconspicuous. They don't make a lot of sound. They'll roost in some dense cedar where you can't see them very well, unless you, like, went into the dense thickets and looked at every single cedar. And they're famous for communal roosts. Long-eared owls are still, and they occur all across the Northern Hemisphere. So there's long-eared owls in Europe. And there's a little tourism industry about this one town, and I want to say Serbia, where it's just it's a village surrounded by farm fields. And apparently they don't use rodenticides, you know, so there are a lot of rodents, and they get, like, hundreds of long-eared owls roosting communally in this town. Like, you're staying in the one hotel and you look out your window and there's, like, six long-eared owls in a tree in the town square or whatever. And so they have this history, when the resources allow it, of roosting communally. And there used to be a communal roost up in Marshfield. You could go see them sitting in these birches. Very calmly, you just walk down the trail and there they were. But they declined, and they're just hard to find. And so always very exciting. And that was a bummer to see
that dead one.
When you see it on the side of the road like that, you know, it probably was crossing the road and right when a car came. That's not a road with a lot of traffic. It was just bad luck. And, you know, sometimes they're slowed down by rodenticides. They eat a lot of rodents, and it's sort of inevitable that they'll have some amount of rodenticides in their blood.
Yeah.
Something we're working to get rid of. But yeah, that was a cool sighting, but it's sort of a tragedy.
That's sad, yeah. All right, so I'm sure there have been some folks watching Boston TV stations who have seen the report on this limpkin in situate. Tell us about that.
The limpkin. Yes, so the limpkin is sort of a strange wading bird that, you know, you associate with South Florida and then all down through the tropics, down through Brazil, as far as northern Argentina. You know, if you spend time in Florida in the winter and you pay attention at all, you may have noticed one somewhere, because they'll be in pretty suburban areas down there, as well as like out in the middle of the Everglades. And they specialize on these big snails, these apple snails. And in addition to the native ones, there are now multiple introduced species of apple snails in this genus, you know, Pomacea. And so they've expanded their range a little bit, you know, into Louisiana, not that far. But for some reason that we don't understand, they've started turning up like way north, like just way further north than they should be, well outside the range of those big snails that they specialize on. And they really specialize. Their bill, the tip of their bill is really good at extracting the meat out of these snails. It's like tweezers. And they can eat other things, but they're really designed, built to eat these big snails. And so just imagine you're in a dense suburban neighborhood in Scituate, and you look out your window and there's this bizarre brown with white streaks bill. They look like a kiwi. If you could picture a kiwi, they're like a cross between that and an egret. You know, they're like a lankier version of that. Long bill, long legs, but brown with white streaks, just like walking around your lawn probing for grubs. That's what it did for several days. And then it started getting really cold and people were like, what do we do? And, you know, there was talk about getting it to a wildlife rehabber. It wasn't clearly injured. It just seemed like maybe it was slowing down in the cold and of hunkering down more. There are a lot of pictures of it just like up against the foundation of somebody's house in the bushes, just sort of hanging out or sleeping. There's a picture of it standing on someone's Tesla, like so strange. this tropical jungle wetland bird, you know. They have great calls. They'd make it into movies a lot, like the old Tarzan movies, apparently.
That's funny.
Just to convey this sense of kind of jungly wildness. But here it was just walking around people's driveways and lawns, probing for grubs. And eventually it disappeared. You know, it really was not built for this climate. Somebody was on the Rare Bird Group Me saying, I called Channel 5 News and I told them. And other people are like, well, what are you doing? Why'd you do that? And they say, well, I want them to ask people to leave their garage doors open for the bird, you know, so it would have a warmer place to spend the night. Like, oh, that was an innovative idea. probably lead to a string of robberies in Scituate. this whole neighborhood's going to have their garage doors open, boys.
Funny. Yeah.
But anyway, but that was the first record for all of New England.
Yeah,
it was a big deal. So that was a big deal for bird watchers, and ultimately probably didn't end well for that limpkin. That's just how it works.
That's how it works. Yeah.
How this aspect of bird natural history, where young birds, apparently a lot of the ones that they're finding dispersing north are 2-year-olds. Mm. I don't know why 2-year-olds versus 1-year-old.
Yeah.
There was a paper about this where they thought maybe it was related to drought, but ultimately I don't think anybody knows why these birds have been going way too far north.
Yeah. Exploring.
It's part of biology. Species explore new areas, and you know, we've seen it with swallowtail kites, which apparently finally did nest here on the I'm sorry. I'm mixing up the kite. They did, I'm sure. We never found it. but also Mississippi kites.
Yep.
Nested this year.
We got to leave it there. Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, look at the time. All right. Catch you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.